Today, elections and consequences.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
For later in the discussion, you'll realize the irony in the comparison with the phrase truth and consequences. Because very often we do end up with this identification in our minds between elections and truth. Now the truth has finally been revealed. I mean, one truth has been revealed. That is, you know, who won the election? And then, even then, it's sometimes dubious. But that one, in general, is what we can draw as a conclusion safely. What I want to do is take a day or two, I think it'll be a couple, and start, inaugurate the conversation based on what election cycles have taught me. And, you know, I've been through a lot of election cycles now, as an adult, as a person participating in the process. In 1980, you know, maybe slightly less than what you would consider a real adult, a 17-year-old who was participating, you know, to the best of my ability. But I learned things from really every election since then, just like you have. And I think maybe considering what some of those things mean might help us as we navigate the response we have to the most recent election and to the coming elections as well, because there are people who are celebrating in a glorious fashion the great triumph of American spirit and so on. And there are others who are grieving, lamenting into their lavender teas about what's happened. I love tea, by the way, so I'm not making fun of the people who drink lavender teas. Lavender is not my favorite flavor, but, you know, you get the point that I'm making. There are, you know, celebrations and lamentations going on around us. So to put it in perspective, I just want to think back over those elections. Not a history lesson. This is me discussing my recollections and what they've meant to me. And in fact, part of what it has meant to me is to recognize the transience of every election. As I think back on mornings when I have awakened to the news, who won? Who won the Senate? Who won the House? How great was the victory? How many states did they win? Which states did they win? And what's that going to mean for the policy that's going to come out next? One of the first things I realize is that I don't have a good, clear recollection of what those were. I think I do. But then when I go back and look up the details, it's like, oh, I thought that was that other election. And, well, that was in 1984. That was in 1992. I thought that happened in 1980 or 1984. And if you say, well, that's just evidence that you have muddy recollection, I mean, that may be true. But that's true about all of us. We combine and confuse ideas into a unified whole because it fits our narrative better. We all do that. We make mistakes. I don't think we try to do it on purpose. But, you know, we compile things into a single record that are not a single record. So obviously there are going to be mistakes that we make along the way. And some of that happened with me. But there are certain things that some of the bigger election cycles have revealed for me, as I look back on them especially, that I don't think I recognized at the time. So when I think back on 1980 and 1984, the huge sweeping victories for Reagan-type republicanism and so on. You know, what part of what those revealed to me was what total victories do and don't mean. And total victories were a different thing then. Back in the 1980s, early 1980s, there was no prospect for Republicans taking over the House of Representatives. The Democrats had a locked hold on it until 1994, by the way. The big, Republican sweep in 1994 that happened during the middle of Bill Clinton's presidency. We'll talk more about that as we go forward, probably in these conversations. But I did learn something in as time has transpired, and I look back on those victories in 1980 and 1984, in the sense that no one would ever beat this kind of president, and he was so popular, Ronald Reagan, I'm talking about, and the Republican movement that was following him was pretty dominant, you know, in the culture. And as Barack Obama spoke about it during his presidency, it was a trajectory changer for the country. And that's what President Obama, Barack Obama, wanted at the time. Senator Obama wanted to see happen with his presidency. And so really, I learned the same thing in 2008 and 2012. That in 1980 and 84, and validated somewhat for me in 1988, you know, was the idea that we've swept in with these conservative policies that are going to, and if I had been on the liberal side, I would have said the same thing in 2008 and 2012. We have swept in to power. Look, no one could stop this tidal movement that's bringing a transformation of our society that will endure, you know, until 1992. When a more popular character shows up on the opposite side in 1992, Bill Clinton's election, and suddenly George H.W. Bush turns into a one-term president. And I'm not even criticizing the man. I'm just saying the reality is I've learned over the years that no matter how dominant or powerful you think your movement is, and it may be for 8 years, for 12 years, it might be. But 8 years and 12 years is not a long time, not anymore. When I was 12 years old, I thought it was, you know, a lifetime. It was when I was 12, but, you know, it's not. And the culture, the society, the laws, the rules, the expectations, the norms and standards of society, they're a different world now than they were in 1980. And some of that is shaped by Reagan's Republicanism, Reaganomics, all of those different policies that went into place, and some of them have been completely swept under the rug since then. So one of the things I've learned is that total victories are never total victories. There's always something on the other side. And even looking back on the catastrophes of history, and I could say it about the great successes of history, but, you know, the catastrophes of history, when the completely wrong people have taken power and exerted all of their authority, they are all in the way, you know, different poets have said it about Napoleon. They're all turning in their graves now. You know, they're in the ground, and the world is just passing on before them as if they were never there. And they want to be recognized. They want to be remembered, but their mausoleums are a testimony that the influence is, you know, brief, no matter how great and long we think it might be. The second thing, by the way, that those kinds of victories reveal to me, and I mean in these victories, especially the 1980-84 Reagan-type wins and the 2008-2012 Obama-type wins, it doesn't matter which direction it's going. One of the things they also reveal is division within the group that was formerly unified. Just as the Republicans found there were the more socially conservative, values-focused voters, and then there were the more economic, you know, private business enterprise and large corporation defense-type Republicans as well, and they were at loggerheads a lot of times during the years when they had all the power. In the same way, under President Obama, we learned that Democrats had this wildly divided, fairly moderate social kind of wing and a completely radical kind of, and I'm on the Republican side, there are complete radicals too. Again, I'm not picking because they're, you know, on the left instead of on the right. I'm saying there are extreme factions within these movements, and then there are more moderate factions within the movement. And the further you go in, you know, gaining power, ascending into the position of authority, the further you're also going to go into those who value one set of ideals over the other, trying to take all of that control for themselves and exclude even the people who used to be in their own family, you know, their own party, as a process of obtaining. It's part of what you recognize as these things happen. By the way, if I'm talking about election cycles, let me not skip the 1992-1996 election cycles, which for me, back then, as a young, completely singly-minded conservative Republican, who would never say I was a Republican, I'm always independent, but always voted Republican. So it was exactly the same thing as being a Republican. I don't know why I thought those weren't the same thing. But in 1992 and 1996, man, it was a comeuppance for us. It made no sense at all for a man who would say, yeah, I tried marijuana, I didn't inhale. It made no sense at all to us that he would be elected. Why would people elect someone like that? That's what we thought in 1992. In 1996, oh, well, surely people will see the consequences of this and so on. What I learned in those two elections, I mean, I learned a lot of things. I mean, for instance, I had to deal with the anomaly. And this one took until about the year 1998 for me to recognize. But I had to deal with the anomaly that this person who was being elected that I thought was a raging liberal, you know, President Clinton, and that's the way he was characterized by the people I was around, that, you know, that he was balancing the budget, that we weren't creating more and more deficit. It was weird. It was like, well, this doesn't make sense. It must be because we have a Republican House. You know, it can't be because this president actually can make sense of what's going on with the budget. Now, I'm not saying that he solved all the problems or that it was the greatest time in American history. I'm not advocating for anything. I'm just saying I had to learn that some of the ways we characterized political leaders were shallow and inaccurate. And, you know, I stopped buying every claim that was made on one side or the other about those political powers when that happened. That's one of the things that came from it. But the other thing that came, and this is what really hit me with Bill Clinton. I didn't believe it was true with Ronald Reagan. I was so young, I didn't grasp how important the dominance of a personality can be. I had read about it regarding Lyndon Johnson, for instance, but it hadn't been demonstrated for me in clear enough a way. But in 1992 and 96, I saw what an overwhelming personality can do. And I mean somebody who, when they walk in the room, people just can't say no to them. They just can't resist them. And Bill Clinton was that, and he was that with more than a room. I mean, he was that on camera. And I know you can look back on it now. If you weren't in those election cycles voting, if you weren't an adult yet, didn't know what was going on, it may not be apparent to you, but I'm telling you, man, it didn't matter. I mean, people used insulting language about him. So this is one of those things where I've probably confused some of the language that was actually used about it. But, you know, I remember people not using the word Teflon about him, but using the word slick about him in an insulting way to say nothing could stick to him. The point was you would come up with a story. Here's a person who's made an accusation, and it would be a pretty bad accusation. And in election cycles before that, if something like that had come out, it pretty much would have been the end of the candidacy. In fact, it still was the end of the candidacy for other people who were even in those two election cycles. But for Bill Clinton, there was the ability to stand there and say, with this good-natured, transparent personality, this transparent-seeming personality, no criticism implied by that, but that's how it seems, would stand, speak to the microphone, look into the camera, and the country would say, yeah, I don't really care about any of that. I'm willing to go with this guy. You know, we're going to follow him. And I saw that for the first time in him. And again, same thing starting in 2016. Didn't matter what you said. Didn't matter what anybody said. The ability for that personality, in this case, Donald Trump, for that personality to stand up and speak to it without wavering, with what appeared to be complete transparency, and nobody can accuse Donald Trump of not speaking his mind. I mean, the man in the moment just says everything that he wants to say. There's something people love about that, and I think there's something similar, although, you know, after some of the impeachment stuff and everything with Bill Clinton, I think, you know, it's been mocked enough, people have made fun of it enough that they sort of view it as, oh, well, he's always manipulating and controlling his language. Some people would say that. But, you know, most people are still pretty overwhelmed by his personality. And the same thing seems to be true about Donald Trump, and I'm pretty sure that will never change. And so what I learned is that an overwhelming personality can pretty much do anything. And I don't mean by that that they do accomplish anything, that they always abuse it. I'm not saying that. But I did realize, I mean, you know, it's something of an unstoppable force when you have someone who's willing to exert the full power of a personality like that. So, you know, these are just a few of the things that, you know, over time I had to acknowledge were different than what I thought coming into elections. You know, coming into it as a young person, you're an ideologue. You think, oh, well, we'll make the best arguments, we'll present the best case, we'll have the most sound reasoning, we'll have the best policies, we'll convince the people, because obviously people are rational. They want to make good decisions. They think through their decisions, and they're always going to do the best thing in the end. And so that's how we'll win elections. And by winning elections, we will shape the future and arrive at not utopia, because there are always some crummy people out there, you know, somewhere, but at the closest you could get to utopia in this kind of world. And, you know, I have not arrived at the opposite conclusion. Oh, what a terrible, stinky place this is always going to be. I haven't arrived there, but I've arrived at a point where elections don't mean that to me. They don't mean, oh, we finally got the right thing done, and now everything's going to be better. Nor do they mean, oh, no, the worst thing possible has happened, and now everything's going to be destroyed because of an election. I'm just not there. I don't see it in either direction. So let me take what I gained from those cycles and talk more generally about what elections overall teach me, the things that they remind me of. And one of those things is simply that people are not the measure of all things. I don't use elections to determine what's true or false. I don't use people's voting to determine what's true or false. I said and thought exactly the same thing about this issue when President Obama was elected, and when President Trump was elected, and when President Biden was elected. That, you know, that election, the determination of who's in charge of the House or who's in charge of the Senate, those don't change what is actually true. And I have read this before a couple of times. I'm going to read it again. We're 170-something episodes into this podcast, so I'm just going to take the privilege of repeating something for a second or third time and say, bear with me. In Plato's, and, you know, it's Plato. Maybe this is worth repeating more than once, right? And, you know, in the spirit of the guy who went to pastor a church and preached a sermon that they loved, and so they called him to be their pastor, and then he came back and preached the same sermon again, and then the third Sunday, the same sermon again. Best sermon they'd ever heard. But by the third time, they're like, oh, no, this guy's only got one sermon. We thought we were getting somebody who could really preach. And so somebody approaches him and says, Pastor, I mean, this is the same sermon three times in a row. And he said, yeah, and as soon as y'all start practicing that one, then I'll move on to the second one. In that spirit, let me just say, this quotation from Plato in Book 6 of the Republic is, I just find, brilliant in making this point that elections don't demonstrate that people have arrived at the truth, finally, because most of us who lead people are not really pursuing the truth. We are instead pursuing whatever would win the election. So, as Plato says it, well, there are mercenary individuals, he says, whom the many call sophists, this is the word for it back in their day, I'm saying, and whom they deem to be their adversaries, do in fact teach nothing but the opinion of the many. Well, we've all experienced this, the sort of put your finger in the air and figure out where the crowd wants to go and join with them and then claim to be their leader, right? That's what this paragraph is describing. And so his way of saying that is there are people whom they call sophists, whom they deem to be their adversaries, that do in fact teach nothing but the opinion of the many, that is to say, the opinions of their assemblies. This is their wisdom. Look, I know how to lead the people. Their wisdom is knowing how to read what the room wants. And so he says, I might compare them to a man who should study the tempers and the desires of a mighty strong beast. The strong beast throughout the rest of this paragraph is the crowd. It's the multitude. It's the population for us. So hear that when you hear the beast, right? So the beast is out there. And, you know, we've adopted this language historically now by calling speeches that feed the beast red meat speeches, right? We're throwing the red meat to the beast. So think of the beast, the crowd, the population, the electorate as the same thing in this paragraph. So he says, I might compare them to a man who should study the tempers and desires of a mighty strong beast who is fed by him. He would learn how to approach and handle him, also at what times and from what causes he is dangerous or the reverse, and what's the meaning of his several cries and by what sounds. And man, do speakers know how to do this? Ooh, look at the, they're going with that. I'm gonna stay on this line for a while. I got him eating. What's the language? Eating out of the palm of my hand. That's the language. So Plato's metaphor here pervades our understanding. It just doesn't pervade our understanding of our own practices. So here's the reminder. So anyway, he would learn how to approach and handle him also at what times and what from what causes he's dangerous or the reverse, and what is the meaning of his several cries and by what sounds when another utters them he's soothed or infuriated. And you may suppose further, that when, by continually attending upon him, he has become perfect in all of this, he calls his knowledge wisdom. I have wisdom. And he makes of it a system or an art, which he proceeds to teach, although he has no real notion of what he means by the principles or the passions of which he is speaking, but calls this honorable. Look how honorable this is. The crowd loves what I'm saying. I must be honorable. This is a statement about all politicians, not a few, not a handful, all politicians. That doesn't mean no one is an exception, but this is what you learn to do if you succeed in politics. You learn to feed the crowd, to get them responding to you, and to say in the authority and power that comes from being able to move the crowd, you must now follow me. I have obtained wisdom. That's what Plato is describing. And so he says, although he calls this honorable and that dishonorable or good or evil or just or unjust, all in accordance with the tastes and tempers of the great brute. Remember, that's the crowd. Good, he pronounces to be that in which the beast delights, and evil to be that which he dislikes. And he can give no other account of them except that the just and the noble are the necessary, having never himself seen and having no power of explaining to others the nature of either or the difference between them, which is immense. Now, as I read that, you are most likely inclined to hear it only being said about the politicians you don't like. The nature of this paragraph's importance will come up later in the discussion. I'll bring it up again in the second time we talk about this next week. But I'll say here from the start, if what you're inclined to hear in that paragraph, well, he's just feeding the beast, you know, he's just saying what people want to hear. If all you hear is all of the things that make you say about some people, well, they're just giving in to the culture. They're just trying to blend into what this evil culture says. If that's all you hear, then you're only hearing half of what this paragraph is saying, because the other half is what I hear coming out of every election cycle since I've been paying attention. Every single time. Well, I told you we were right. That's why we won the election. That is exactly the same thing this paragraph just described. We'll get into more detail about it later on, but it's just as important as the idea that you think you're placating the culture by feeding the beast and that that's evil. If that's evil, then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be bragging when we win an election as if it proves that we're right, which we'll talk more about later on in the discussion. The same problem, reminder, lesson also comes up in the Gospels. You know, and so for me, I'm trying to be an interpreter of Christianity, a follower of Jesus in the best way that I can. I'm trying to help those who claim to be followers of Jesus and those who are followers of Jesus, you know, understand better how to do that. That's my calling. That's what I do. So as I look at the Gospels, exactly the same lesson is taught. because there is no compliment implied in the Jewish leaders fearing the people. Remember in Matthew 21, it says it this way, when this is after Jesus tells a parable that pretty obviously throws them under the bus. It says, when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived he was speaking about them, and although they were seeking to arrest him, and here, these are religious leaders. You know, people you would think are motivated by what's right. Well, you know, this is the right thing to do, so we need to do it. The people who are supposed to be motivated like that, it says, and although they were seeking to arrest him, which if he's doing wrong and they have the authority, they should do, right? But although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowds because the crowds held him to be a prophet. Well, I mean, we don't want to go against the beast, you know. Heaven forbid we should try to do something with the brute when he's ill-tempered. Nobody should lead that group. So the idea is the same, and it's an insult in Matthew. There's no doubt Matthew is making clear that Jesus is going the right direction and that the people who are on the opposite side are so motivated by their need to keep the beast tamed, to keep the crowd at their heel, that they're not willing to do even what they think would be right in the moment. They're more afraid of the crowd. And let me just pause here and insert that if you think to yourself, well, look, you're mischaracterizing this because we're a democracy, a representative democracy, but a democracy, you know, we care about what the people say. And as I look at the Gospels, and I'm saying this because I do hear this sentiment a lot. Not explicitly, not people getting up and saying the words, you know, Jesus was a populist, but with the sentiment, oh, the crowds, the rabble, the hoi polloi, they were following Jesus. That's who he is. He's the one that gets out among them and he riles up the labor population, the blue-collar workers, and he gets them on his side. That's our Jesus. That's a complete misunderstanding on one side. And also cherry-picking of the evidence on the other side, reading of the Gospels. Because, you know, the crowds that elect Jesus to be king, let's crown him now, he rejects them. The crowds that say, oh, we're going to follow him no matter where he's going, he rejects them. He pushes them away because he knows what's true about their hearts. That's how John says it. And the crowd ultimately rejects him. When they see what he's really about, again, the passage in John as an example, or when they realize, in truth, he might be threatening their day-to-day lives. We have no king but Caesar, would be the declaration. Jesus is anything but a populist. That's not it. He is absolutely coming, representing a truth that he's not going to compromise for the sake of all of the people, everyone. High and low, noble, everyone. That's why he comes, but not as the lion tamer, to learn the beast, figure out what they want, and then be able to draw them all behind. He's not a populist. He's not figuring out what the crowd wants and giving it to them. He comes and does quite the opposite of that, which is why he ends up on a cross. At the hands of those who are in authority and at the hands of those who are in the street. No one is expunged from their guilt in the crucifixion of Jesus. No one. Not even his closest followers, by the way, who abandon him in the moment. Everyone is a part of rejecting Christ, which should tell us our way of thinking of the population, our way of thinking of the electorate and their choices about leadership and everything else should probably be different than thinking that they determine what is true. Not saying that they shouldn't have authority, not saying that elections shouldn't happen, not saying we shouldn't be a democracy. I believe in all of those things being the case, that we should listen to the population, that they should have the authority, that we ought to have democratic elections and live by the consequences of it, regardless of the direction that goes. I believe in all of that, but it doesn't make what the crowd does right. So how do we put all that together? That's part of what we're talking about. So the other thing that every single election, you know, has taught me now, as I look back on all the elections I've lived through, just right off the bat, is that rhetorician politicians, you know, and so, I mean, this is what we mean by politicians So I was on the platform at a pro-life event with a person who had never run for public office before and was in that moment. And man, they were playing all the rhetorical political cards. I mean, everything from billboards to everything else. It was all the, and I'll say rhetoric. I really want to say cheap rhetoric. They were playing all the cheap rhetoric they could play to win the election. Understandable. I get it. And they weren't an evil person. They just were trying to win their election. Fine. I called that person a politician from the platform. I just said, and now you'll hear from the politician who's going to address this because they were a politician. They're trying to win a political seat. First thing he said when he got up, I'm no politician. I'll tell you that. I just wanted to laugh out loud. I didn't. I just, sat and nodded and, cooperated with the meeting. It wasn't my meeting. But every rhetorician politician extrapolates the data. This is the thing I've learned. You know what I mean by this. They take the information that is there because you can't build from nothing. No one can build from nothing. So you can try it, but even the most dominant personalities connect with something in the crowd's audience. Something in the audience, I mean, something has to resonate. Something where they say, something like that, something similar to that did happen to me. I get where he's coming from or where she's coming from. So what the rhetoricians do, though, is they extrapolate from the data. They move outside what the data actually is to the conclusions that they want to draw or that they believe are most helpful for their cause. So, I mean, every ad is an example of this, every political ad. Of which all of us were just nauseated, over the last several months. And so grateful, right? The day after the election when you wake up and none of those ads are on television. It's like, hallelujah. I'm just so glad to see a cereal commercial or an insurance commercial. Anyway, which is weird, isn't it? But we do. I mean, it's just a relief to have that experience. So anyway, the point is, when you consider, consider as an example, the villainizing language that comes into political campaigns. I don't know how many times I heard the phrase this election cycle because I live in Dallas. The phrase, soft on crime, Democrat judges. I heard that language until I would just turn the TV off. It's like, come on. What you're doing is just saying a whole class of people, not just individuals, but every single person who's this political affinity or holds this office is just soft on crime. They don't care. That kind of villainizing language isn't without a foundation. It's not like there's no evidence that somebody does or doesn't rule harder or softer on criminals in cases. I'm not saying there's no data point whatsoever, but I'm saying, come on, the generalization. The extrapolation of that data, it's just like almost too much, right? Same thing with the phrase too liberal for Texas, or on the opposite side, if you care about democracy, as if anyone who would vote for a Republican must not care about democracy anymore, even though they're showing up to vote, which would be an expression of democracy in the process. I get where the concerns are. There is a data point there. There is something there that would make a person say, because I care about democracy, I couldn't vote for those Republicans. Or because I care about limiting crime, I couldn't vote for those Democrats. I get why a person could make that argument, but the nature of a politician or a rhetorician is to play the crowd by saying, and this extends to everyone of that ilk, to everyone of that kind, and to every decision you are about to make. And the goal is to universalize a negative perception. The idea that, you're not going to believe this, but it's absolutely true. When I've told some people, that Democrat, this person that's running for the office or this whatever that I've met is a Christian. They are a committed Christian involved in their church, active in their faith, practicing it regularly. And I know Democrats who are like that. They're like, what? I thought nobody who was a Democrat could be a Christian. Or the statement on the other side, Republicans just want to control your body. Well, I don't know any Republicans who want to do that. That doesn't mean there aren't policies that have that effect. It doesn't mean that there's no data point to start from. But the universal claim, well, if you're a Republican, you just want to control everybody else's bodies, is an extrapolation of that data point. And it's also, it's easy to do when we use villainizing language. Those nasty people, those evil Democrats, those wicked Republicans. It's why we can't even talk about concerns that are legitimate. If you want to talk about economic policy and socialism on one side, or social policy and fascism on the other side, can't do it, because once you introduce the term, now you're just universalizing everything villainous about other people and blah, 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 instead of just sitting down and having a conversation about the reality of it. Now, my point is, it's in the nature of a politician to do that because he's read the beast. He knows where the fears are, and he knows what satisfies the appetites of the beast. So it is true that some politicians do that. This is just what I've gained in my experience watching election cycles. It is true that some people do that maliciously. They do exactly what Plato describes. They find the data point, turn it into a universal cause. So all of a sudden you have an immigrant who commits a crime. Every immigrant now is a danger to society. And a transgender athlete who cheats the system in some way, according to a lot of people's judgments. And now you have a universal fear. Your women aren't even going to be able to go to college anymore because they're not going to get the scholarships and so on. Or a woman denied medical care. And now, because somebody had a case that was too much for the Texas system to handle under the current laws, which I understand happens, now it's every woman's going to face this crisis. We take a data point and we turn it into a universal cause because we need it to be an immediate threat so that we'll roar as a beast. No, this shall not be. You're not going to do that to my society. And the politicians feed that. And some, I think, do it maliciously. But I want to say, on the other hand, and you're not going to believe I'm about to say this, I think most of them do it sincerely. Most of them do it because they believe what they're saying. They have in their own minds sincerely extrapolated the data point into something that they believe is true. And the reason I'm saying this is because even rhetoricians are not omniscient. They're not these all-wise, so brilliant manipulators of society that they know exactly how to control everyone. Nobody is really like that. So they're not omniscient, but they're also not flat characters. They're not cartoon characters. And we have an obligation, because we exist in society, to attribute human characteristics to people. I mean, they're human, right? So attributing human characteristics means we have to regard most people as being sincere in what they're saying, unless we have demonstrable evidence otherwise. That doesn't mean you have to think what they're saying makes sense, or that you agree with it, or that you're complicit with it. But it does mean you don't have to attribute motives that say they're lying, they're just deceiving when they say these things. Most of the time, in other words, what I'm saying to you is they probably believe what they're saying. And in some ways, this is a good thing, and in some ways, this is a bad thing. So let me take this episode at least to this point. The other thing I've learned in election cycles is that people trust their political leaders. That doesn't mean they trust every political leader, but it does mean they pick a political leader and they put their trust in that person. It's a part of being a human being. It's part of understanding Scripture, the nature of the Messiah, the federal headship of Christ, the fact that he stands in for us. Is us looking at a leader and saying, oh, we have someone who can lead the way for us. It's part of who we are as human beings. Most people trust their political leaders. And in some ways, that's unfortunate, you know, given the above, because their political leaders are playing them, their passions, their fears, all of their anxieties, and all of their sometimes petty desires, sometimes good desires. They're playing all of that into a maelstrom of these offers of promises and commitments and so on. So in some ways, it's unfortunate that people trust their political leaders so much. But in other ways, it's very, very fortunate. because we need leadership. We need people who stand in front of us and actually do give us guidance. Jesus' lamentation over Jerusalem is, and it's always bothered me. This is going to sound terrible, doesn't it? I mean, it bothers me. That doesn't mean I think he's wrong. I know he's right. I know Jesus is always right. So when he says something or when Scripture says something that is an anomaly to me, it bothers me. Not because it's wrong, but because I know something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with my way of understanding the world. And this one is a big one. That Jesus' lamentation looking over Jerusalem and saying they're like sheep without a shepherd is such, you know, it's such a statement that troubles me in the sense that people can't rule their own lives. They can't rationally govern their own society. They can't be in charge just as a diffuse, decentralized power of interests coalescing into a functioning society. You can't have that. You got to have somebody stand at the front and give them direction? Yes, you do. And that's just the reality of human nature. We have to have somebody who's in charge. And so we're fortunate that people are always looking for a leader. So, you know, what we end up with in all of these things that I'm just observing in all these elections, and again, this is not the end of the conversation. This is just the very beginning of what I really want to get to, which is what we need to remember about those people. And what we need to remember about ourselves in the process of all these elections and what it comes out to mean for how we ought to practice our Christianity. That's what I want to get to next time. But, you know, to this point, what I want to get to is that what we end up with is in all of these elections, in all of these election cycles, a litany of rhetoric addressing issues which may or may not even actually immediately affect us, but does immediately motivate us. And so what I want in this first step, and again, it's just a preliminary step. What I want to invite us to do, all of us to do, is examine ourselves and say, wait, which part of this election was actually critically important about the direction we're going to go, or what's happening in the society, or what's going to happen at my workplace tomorrow, or in the life of my church or my ministry or whatever? What's actually that? And which part is a bunch of drummed up rhetoric to feed the beast? And maybe just turn away a little bit from the red meat. Maybe just, you know, pull back a little bit and put something a little more solid into your diet as you consider what it's going to mean for you in the way you belong to this society, lead out in your own convictions and the things you actually believe, and commit to continuing to follow the one you've actually given your life to if you're a follower of Christ. That's where I want us to get. And again, a lot more detail in the conversations that we'll come to next week as we pick up what we ought to remember about us as people and what we ought to think about you personally, in our own life as we process through all of this. More next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.